In 1964, a gentleman by the name of Paul Gatling was convicted of a murder he did not commit. The victim, Lawrence Rothbart, had been shot and killed in his home in the Crown Heights neighborhood of Brooklyn the previous year. Gatling had been allegedly placed at the or near the scene of the crime at about the same time that the shooting took place. And so on the basis of that identification, detectives brought him in, arrested him, and questioned him for hours before they let him speak to his attorney. He was then placed in a lineup with three other men who were noticeably shorter than him. The widow of the victim was brought in to take a look at the lineup, and even sitting there looking at these men, she did not identify Gatling, even though she was told numerous times, focus on the tall one. A few nights later, Mrs. Rothbart went back to the police station where she witnessed and got to watch some of the questioning of Gatling, and it was only then that she identified him as her husband's killer. Based on that identification, Gatling was charged with murder. His attorney persuaded him to plead guilty to avoid the possibility of the death penalty. And he was sentenced to 30 years to life in prison. About a week after that, he petitioned the court to have his plea overturned and withdrawn, and the judge denied his request. And so over the next decades, he would continue to proclaim his innocence and petition the court in appeal after appeal after appeal, only to have those appeals denied. Fast forward 50 years, and a division of the district attorney's office known as the Conviction Review Unit became aware of Gatling's case and started looking into it, and they uncovered evidence that had been withheld that pointed to Gatling's innocence, which was enough to overturn the verdict. So after 50 years, a Brooklyn judge finally exonerated Paul Gatling, now 81 years old, officially clearing his record. The district attorney also issued a public apology for the wrongful conviction and imprisonment. Of course, those 50 years that Paul Gatling spent in prison are years that he would never get back. Now, of course, that is a very dramatic example of injustice, and yet we know those types of things happen in our world, along with a variety of other kinds of injustice. For example, there can be unjust laws that privilege some people over others. There can be unjust hiring practices. Probably one of the more common forms of injustice, although we might not use this word to describe it, is the way that people sometimes will spread lies and rumors about people that have no basis in reality. And we know how damaging those rumors and lies can be to people and their reputations. It's also not uncommon for people who are in positions of power to use that power in unjust ways toward those who are underneath them. And over the course of our lives, it is highly likely that one or more times in our life, we will experience some form of injustice. At the very least, we will be mistreated at some point. As the saying goes, life isn't fair. Experiencing injustice is just another aspect of what it means to live in a fallen world. So since this is going to be something that we know we're going to experience, the question comes to us of how do we respond to those moments, either when injustice happens to us or we might see it happen to somebody else? Is there a way that we respond? And maybe to make that a little bit more specific, is there a biblical way that we can respond? Well, that's what we're going to look at this morning as we return to the life of Paul in Acts chapter 25. But before we dive into that, let's give a little bit of background on where Paul has been since we last left him back in chapter 21. Last week, we saw him as he's getting on the boat and officially making his trek to Jerusalem, which he does. He gets there, and he ministers there for a while. And not surprisingly, as has happened everywhere else he's gone, he's run afoul of the Jews in the synagogue. Actually, the Jews in the temple this time. And so they bring him in. They bring these kind of inflated charges against him that he's been preaching against the Hebrew law. They make a false accusation against him that he's brought an unclean Gentile into the temple, which he did not do. And they form a mob, they bring him in, and they literally just beat him up in the temple right there. And all of this just happens very, very fast. And so, of course, nobody has paused long enough to find out if any of these charges are factual. Everybody's just joined the mob. When the people in the temple find out that they brought him in and they hear the charges against him, they join the crowd and they want to kill Paul as well. But who should step in to save the day but the commander of the Roman soldiers there in Jerusalem steps in and pulls Paul out of this chaos and brings him aside, especially after he finds out that Paul is a Roman citizen. He rescues Paul from his own people. Eventually, Paul tries to give a defense of himself, which does not go well. It just incites the crowd even more. And so they evacuate him. The Roman soldiers get him out of there and transfer him into the custody of Felix. Not Felix the cat, not Felix Unger. You didn't think you were going to hear that name this morning, did you? Felix Unger. There's a few people in here who just do not know that name. I know that. But Felix, the regional governor of Caesarea. And so over and over again, we continue to see Paul just experience injustice after injustice after injustice. Now at the hands of Felix, this governor. And even though Felix is familiar with Paul's case, he knows the details, and even deep down probably knows that Paul's not guilty of any of this stuff, he keeps Paul in prison for 2 years. What's interesting is during those 2 years, Felix keeps calling him in to talk to him, not because he wants to hear what Paul has to say, but he's hoping Paul will offer him a bribe to get out of prison. And then we're told in the closing words of chapter 24, when 2 years had passed, Felix was succeeded by Porcius Festus. But because Felix wanted to grant a favor to the Jews, he left Paul in prison. So no grounds for keeping him. He just wanted to do a favor to the Jews. And again, we see Paul continue to experience these injustices. And that's where we pick the story up in Acts chapter 25. We're going to read the first 12 verses of chapter 25. 3 days after arriving in the province, Festus went up from Caesarea to Jerusalem, where the chief priests and the Jewish leaders appeared before him and presented the charges against Paul. They requested Festus as a favor to them to have Paul transferred to Jerusalem, for they were preparing an ambush to kill him along the way. Festus answered, "Paul is being held at Caesarea, and I myself am going there soon. Let some of your leaders come with me, and if the man has done anything wrong, they can press charges against him there." After spending 8 or 10 days with them, Festus went down to Caesarea. The next day, he convened the court and ordered that Paul be brought before him. When Paul came in, the Jews who had come down from Jerusalem stood around him. They brought many serious charges against him, but they could not prove them. Then Paul made his defense. And I love how simple his defense is. "I have done nothing wrong against the Jewish law or against the temple or against Caesar." Festus, wishing to do the Jews a favor, said to Paul, "Are you willing to go up to Jerusalem and stand trial before me there on these charges?" Paul answered, "I am now standing before Caesar's court where I ought to be tried. I have not done anything wrong to the Jews, as you yourself know very well. If, however, I am guilty of doing anything deserving death, I do not refuse to die. But if the charges brought against me by these Jews are not true, no one has the right to hand me over to them. I appeal to Caesar." After Festus had conferred with his council, he declared, "You have appealed to Caesar. To Caesar you will go." And so we see the Jews, Paul's enemies in this case, they don't really have a lot of new tricks up their sleeve. They're up to the same old things that they've always been up to, fabricating a bunch of charges against him. And then when they try to move Paul, they're trying to set him up for an ambush. We're seeing the exact same thing they tried to do back in chapter 23 when Paul is under the custody of the Roman commander. Which was a bold move that they wanted to try to attack Paul while he was in Roman custody. But there's nothing new here. They're still trying the same old things. It didn't work the first time, but they're going to try it again. And I can imagine them going to Festus and saying, you know, Festus, Caesarea is just so far for us to travel, which was not a completely unreasonable thing because Caesarea is about 75 miles from Jerusalem. Caesarea is just so far to travel to prosecute Paul. And so why don't you transfer him to Jerusalem, here to Jerusalem, and then we'll have a trial for him here. Now, Festus doesn't seem to see the point in wasting all of these resources to bring Paul to Jerusalem since he's going to Caesarea anyway. And he convinces Paul's accusers to, well, if you want to try him, I'm going. You can come with me. We'll just bring him out and we'll take care of this. And again, pretty much the same thing happens. They come to Caesarea. Paul's brought out in this kind of mock trial type situation. They make a very weak case against him. He states his defense, and then that's it. But in this case, we see Festus does eventually give in to the Jews, because in verse 9, and he does so for the very same reason that Felix had. He wanted to do the Jews a favor. And so he gives in. He does have Paul transferred to Jerusalem, or at least issues the command to have Paul transferred to Jerusalem. And what's interesting is that I think he does this knowing full well that this is what's waiting for Paul. This is probably a death sentence for him, which gives you the idea that this was probably a little bit of a pragmatic move for Festus. He can't do anything with Paul, but he can put him in a position where the problem will take care of itself. Paul also knows that if he goes from where he is back to Jerusalem, he's probably not going to make it there alive. And so he does the only thing left that he has to do. He appeals to Caesar. Now, that seems like maybe a little bit of a strange thing here. But one of the privileges that Roman citizens had, and we see that Paul has stated on numerous occasions that he's a Roman citizen, one of the privileges was the ability to appeal your case to the emperor. Especially if it felt like it was stalling, if he felt like you were really facing injustice. And since Paul's a Roman citizen, that's exactly what he ends up doing. He understands the injustice that he's facing, and he's left with no other option but to appeal to the emperor himself. As we've been seeing, Paul, again, is he's suffering one injustice after another. At this point in the story, he's been in prison for more than 2 years, with no end in sight. He's been repeatedly denied justice, and yet through it all, one of the things that just strikes me about his whole thing is just how exemplary his conduct is, how well he carries himself through this whole ordeal. And that brings us to what I believe, at least for today, in looking at this passage, is what the main point or main idea of this passage is, and that's that God calls us to respond to injustice. And he calls us to respond in a way that glorifies him. God calls us to respond to injustice in a way that glorifies him. Paul demonstrates that we don't just have to passively accept everything that comes at us. But we also see that injustice was not just something that Paul experienced or that other people experienced. It's also something that we experience on various levels and to varying degrees. And again, that really shouldn't surprise us because just like Paul lived in a world that was full of sin, we live in a fallen world with fallen people in charge of things and with sinful hearts. Injustices are going to take place. We should expect that, and yet God calls us to, which means we're kind of given permission to pursue justice. God calls us to respond to injustice, but to do it in a way that glorifies him. And I think we can see this not just in this specific situation and instance that Paul is involved in, but we can also see this all throughout the narrative of Paul's life, specifically as he's going through his imprisonment in Jerusalem and in Rome. And I think what we can find here is through all of that, there are five things that we see in the life of Paul in which we can respond to justice and do it in a way that glorifies God, that honors God. And these aren't going to get easier as we go, I just want to tell you that. Except for maybe the last one. But the first thing that we see here is that we have to remember that God is working. That can be very hard to remember, especially when you're in the midst of something where you just can't quite see what God is doing. We need to remind ourselves that God is at work, and not just in some general way out in the world. He's also at work in and through the circumstances that we're going through. He hasn't taken a break. He hasn't fallen asleep at the wheel. He is actively working to accomplish his purposes. We've already seen back in Acts 18, I believe it was, and we see another scene in Acts 23 that is very reminiscent of that, where Paul needs to be reminded of this by God himself. God appears to Paul again and speaks to him in a dream. And he says, take courage. As Paul is sitting in a prison cell, take courage. You're testifying about me in Jerusalem. You're also going to testify about me in Rome. Which had to have been a little bit of a pick-me-up for Paul, because all this time, and if you read his letter to the Romans, he talks about how much he has longed to go to Rome. And God is saying, you think that this imprisonment might be getting in the way of me using you? No, I'm going to use your imprisonment to pull off the exact thing that I have planned for you. And you're going to end up going to Rome anyway. And we see that happen as Paul makes his appeal to Caesar. And this isn't the only time we see God do something like this, to use injustice to bring about his purposes. It reminds me of the story of Joseph in Genesis. You want to talk about a guy that suffered injustice? At the hands of his brothers. Now, granted, I won't blame Joseph for what happened to him, but come on. He was a little bit of a show-off. But his brothers are jealous of him because of how much their father loves him above the rest of them, basically. And so they kidnap him, they sell him into slavery in Egypt, which is where he ends up. But God raises him up, he ends up in a position of power, only to be falsely accused by his boss's wife of trying to take advantage of her, where he ends up in an Egyptian prison. But even while he's there, God again uses him. He raises him up. He uses him to interpret this dream that Pharaoh has about this famine that's coming. And as a result of that, Pharaoh makes him the second most powerful person in Egypt. That drought and famine does eventually come. And because of Joseph's leadership and because of how God has used him, guess where all the food is? In Egypt. Guess who comes looking for food? His brothers. Now, his brothers don't know that it's Joseph when they first encounter him, but when they realize it's him, oh my goodness, they probably had to change their tunics. They're scared to death. They know that they are at the mercy of their kid brother. But because God has been working, because God has been not just working in the situation, but working in Joseph's life, he says these words to them that not only had to have a deep impact on them, they have echoed through the centuries. He looks at his brothers and he goes, you know what? You intended this to harm me. He doesn't sugarcoat it. He knows he knows they didn't want him to survive this. You intended to harm me. God intended this for good. And as a result of everything that happened, as a result of the situation that Joseph found himself in, he was able to be used of God to provide for all of these people who otherwise would have died. They would have starved to death. God used Joseph. He used those circumstances. He used that injustice. Of course, the greatest example of God using something like that is not seen in the life of Paul or Joseph. It's Jesus. Jesus suffered the greatest injustice, and he did so willingly. And as Peter said in his famous sermon at Pentecost, all of that happened according to God's deliberate plan and foreknowledge. It was all by the design of God. And his purpose in doing it was to redeem fallen humanity. God used the most outrageous injustice ever committed against Jesus to carry out the greatest rescue mission the world has ever known. So whenever we experience injustice in our lives, the first thing we need to do is to remember and remind ourselves that God is still at work. He hasn't stopped moving. Even if we don't understand what he's doing, even if it's hard to see, I can imagine when Joseph's sitting in that prison cell before he's brought into, he's thinking, man, I just don't have any idea where this is going. Joseph had to remind himself, God had to remind him that he was still at work. He's still accomplishing his purposes, even in and through our circumstances. The second way to respond to injustice in a godly way is to leave vengeance to God. Again, I said these weren't going to get any easier. And what's interesting is this language comes from Paul himself, not in this story, but in his letter to the Romans. In Romans 12, he says this: "Do not repay anyone evil for evil. Be careful to do what is right in the eyes of everyone. If it is possible, as far as it depends on you, live at peace with everyone. Do not take revenge, my dear friends, but leave room for God's wrath, for it is written, 'It is mine to avenge, I will repay,' says the Lord." That is not our natural inclination. Our natural inclination is to seek revenge. Sometimes, depending on how much we have been wronged, we want to lash out and seek revenge any way possible. And yet God tells us, vengeance is mine. I will repay. That's, man, that is hard. And yet that is what we have instructed in. That's what we're commanded to do. And that's precisely what we see Paul doing. Now, of course, his opportunities for vengeance are admittedly limited. He's in prison under guard, and so he doesn't really have a lot of opportunity for revenge. But we do get a glimpse of this in Acts 23 as he's standing in front of the Sanhedrin. And he's proclaiming his innocence. He's preaching this message. And the high priest says to one of the other temple officials there to strike Paul on the mouth. And Paul says, God's going to strike you, you whitewashed wall. Now, Paul definitely speaks his mind here, and he speaks it in a very direct way, but you notice that he even communicates this, that Paul's not the one the high priest has to be afraid of. God's going to be the one who gets to exact vengeance. Now, of course, he apologizes quickly thereafter because he didn't realize that the person he was speaking against was the chief priest, and so we still see Paul, even in those moments, being slightly gracious and showing how much he honors his heritage and stuff like that, because you were not supposed to speak evil against the God's leader, God's ruler. But this is a great reminder for us, not only in how Paul demonstrates this, but just in general, because we need to remember, there's a day of reckoning coming for everyone who treats others unjustly. Nobody is ultimately going to get away with anything. There's coming a day when perfect justice will be administered, when every offense will be made known and exposed. And if that makes you uncomfortable, that's probably the Holy Spirit telling you there's something you need to deal with. But there's also a sense of comfort that we can take in that the wrongs that we have suffered, many times we need to leave the justice of that in God's hands. It's in light of that coming day of judgment that we can do that, knowing and trusting that we serve a God of justice, and that there's going to be one day where he's just going to set everything right. But that also means that we need to leave it to him to decide what needs to be set right. A third way to respond to injustice in a way that glorifies God is to love our enemies. So after you decide that you're not going to take vengeance on them, you need to take the next step and actively love them. While Paul is incarcerated, he repeatedly shows more concern for the spiritual well-being of the people who are guarding him, those who are in authority over him, than he does for his own interests. Even though he skillfully defends himself, even though he takes advantage of the legal right that he has to appeal to Caesar, over and over and over again we see that his main interest is in sharing the gospel with anybody he comes into contact with, whether it's the hostile mob in Acts 22 or Felix in Acts 24 or with Festus and King Agrippa. In the next chapter, in chapter 26, everywhere he goes, even while he's in prison, Paul demonstrates this deep, genuine love and concern for the spiritual welfare of those who are involved in the injustices that are being enacted against him. He exhibits love for his enemies. Now, we know that Paul didn't just manufacture this feeling out of nowhere. He gets this from Jesus himself. Not just the teachings of Jesus, but Jesus' own example. But in the teachings, Jesus says in Luke 6, "But to you who are listening, I say," and it's interesting when Jesus says that because he knows that not everybody's going to be able to hear this and accept this. "For those of you who are willing to listen to this, I say, love your enemies. Do good to those who hate you. Bless those who curse you. Pray for those who mistreat you." I'm not sure there is anything more countercultural, especially less than, we're close to 60 days probably, out from a presidential election. I cannot think of anything that's more countercultural than the behavior that Jesus commands in these verses. Now, I'm no anthropologist, but I can't imagine there's ever been a culture in history where this has been a popular thing to do, to love your enemies. That mentality is radically contrary to human nature. Our natural inclination is to despise our enemies, not love them. And yet Jesus not only tells us to love our enemies, he shows us what that actually looks like. He loved us sacrificially even while we were still his enemies. And incredibly, as he's dying in agony on the cross, he prays for the people who are carrying out his crucifixion. He is the ultimate example of what it looks like to love your enemies. So here's a practical challenge for you this week. Most of us probably are not going to have to think too hard about this. Pick a person who has wronged you. And then start praying for that person on a regular basis. Now, here's a caveat. You are not allowed to pray imprecatory prayers. Do you know what imprecatory prayers? You know when David is praying fire down on his enemies? That's an imprecatory prayer. Those are off limits. Pray for God's blessing on them and his work in them and for them. Now, they do not have to become your best buddy, because there's some instances where it's just not a smart thing to keep putting yourself in a position where somebody's going to harm you. But if you want to take steps to hoping that they don't harm you, they need their heart transformed. And so the best way to do that is to pray for them and see if God doesn't use that to, in some sense, warm your heart toward them and allow you to start loving them with the love of Christ. Pray for your enemies. Love your enemies. A fourth God-glorifying way to respond to injustice is to actively pursue justice. Be active in your pursuit of justice. Again, I don't really... some people will tend to use Jesus' statement about when somebody slaps you on one cheek, turn to them the other also. That doesn't mean that we just need to passively let everything happen to us. There are legitimate ways that we can pursue justice. We see Paul doing this in verse 11 when he appeals to Caesar. By that, he shows us that it is perfectly acceptable to utilize the legal options that are available to us to pursue justice. From the very beginning of his incarceration in Acts 22, he's not shy about telling people he's a Roman citizen. That's what he tells the Roman guard. Is it lawful to arrest a Roman citizen or to throw a Roman citizen in prison without a trial? There was nothing wrong with that. He wasn't stepping outside of the means or doing something illegitimate. He was active in his pursuit of justice. We see it again as he makes his appeal to Caesar. He doesn't just roll over and let whatever is going to happen happen to him. He actively seeks to defend himself and win his case and maybe even preserve his life, even though he's willing to die if necessary. You see, Scripture doesn't tell us that we're supposed to be passive about injustice, either the injustices committed against us or those committed against others. Vengeance, yes, we leave to God, but vengeance and justice are not the same thing. They're two different things. Our faith in a God of justice should lead us to be very active and sometimes even passionate in our pursuit of justice, through the proper methods. One of the best examples of this is a man by the name of William Wilberforce. If you're familiar with that name, he predates all of the anti-slavery work in the United States. Wilberforce was a Christian and a member of the British Parliament in the late 1700s, early 1800s. He passionately pursued justice in his work to get rid of the slave trade in the British Empire, which was no easy task. You know, we talked a couple weeks ago about how central Artemis worship was to the economy of Ephesus. That was slavery in the British Empire. There were people who did not believe the British Empire could exist, survive, or at all without slavery. In 1793, Wilberforce proposed a bill in the House of Commons that made provisions for the gradual, this wasn't even the immediate abolition, it was the gradual abolition of the slave trade. It was soundly defeated. Many members of Parliament didn't even show up to vote because they didn't want to go on record of where they stood on the issue. That was not the only time he tried to introduce legislation. 1792, 97, 98, 99, 1804, 1805. To his dismay, every single one of those bills was defeated as well. On top of that, Wilberforce suffered a debilitating illness that kept him bedridden, probably related to all of the stress that he suffered, that kept him bedridden for weeks at a time. There were all kinds of outrageous rumors that circulated about him. He faced multiple assassination attempts, and yet he did not give up. He was so passionate and tenacious in his pursuit of justice that he just simply refused to give in. And then finally, in 1807, because of his efforts, largely because of his efforts, Parliament passed a bill, a law that at long last abolished the slave trade in the British Empire. After 20 years of thankless and tireless campaigning, justice had won. But Wilberforce wasn't even done there, because now came the hard work of making sure that the law that had been passed was enforced. 26 years later, just before his death, he lived to see Parliament pass another law, this time not just abolishing the slave trade, but abolishing the entire practice of slavery in the British Empire. He understood that faith in a God of justice should motivate us to do more than anyone else in our society to pursue justice. Even though the gospel, and really the gospel is the vehicle behind this, even though the gospel itself is obviously our primary focus, it is also very appropriate for us to exhibit love for God and for our neighbors by seeking justice more, in seeking for a more just society for everyone. Then a final way to respond to injustice in a way that glorifies God, and this is the good news, we set our focus on our eternal hope. We've talked about remembering that God's at work, we leave vengeance to him, we love our enemies, we actively pursue justice, and now we set our focus on our eternal hope. One of the more conspicuous ways that Paul conducts himself all throughout his imprisonment is that he always seems to be calm, collected, confident, and courageous. And I know that was a lot of alliteration. And the reason that he's able to remain calm, collected, confident, and courageous is because, regardless of what happened to him, he had an eternal hope. Where that applies to us is we have the exact same eternal hope that Paul had. In 2 Corinthians, he writes about this hope. He tells the church there that even though he knows outwardly his body's just breaking down, he's wasting away, he probably doesn't have a whole lot of time left, even though the outside is breaking down, he knows that there's an eternal glory that awaits him that far surpasses any temporary struggle or difficulty that he faces today. We have that same hope. Regardless of what it looks like on the outside, we know the end of the story. We know that we have this hope, and as he will write somewhere else, that hope is not going to disappoint us. It's something that we confidently place our faith in spite of not being able to physically see it. Sometimes that's what, well, most of the time, that's what we have to do to get through the injustice that we face, and sometimes to help others navigate the injustices they face. We have to walk by faith and not by sight. We will be triumphant one day. I remember when we preached on, when I went through the letters, the seven letters in Revelation, there was multiple times where Jesus said, to him who overcomes will be given the crown of life. To him who focuses their eternal hope on me and the redemption and restoration that I'm going to bring, that's, you can get through this. There's good news. We will be triumphant one day in a new heaven and a new earth where injustice will be nothing more than a distant memory. That's the hope that the gospel gives us. That's the gospel empowers us to face all the injustice in this world by giving us a hope that's beyond this world. A hope for a glorious future. And the more that we fix our focus on that eternal hope, the more we're able to appreciate just how wonderful that future is going to be, even in the face of injustice. And so here in the life of Paul and in this experience that he walked through and went through, we can see that we don't have to just sit back and let everything happen to us. We can respond to injustice and we can respond in ways that glorify God by remembering that he is at work. He hasn't stopped moving. But I'm going to repeat that line. If you're not dead, he's not done. And even after you die, he's still not done because he's still working. But we need to also leave vengeance to him. He's a God of justice. And yeah, it's difficult because sometimes the justice that we have in mind is probably going to look a little bit different than what God has in mind. But we leave that to him. We love our enemies while actively pursuing justice, all the while keeping our focus fixed on the eternal hope that we have, knowing that there's going to come a day when God's going to set all of this right. And so we walk with hope. We walk with the same single-minded focus that Paul did, that allowed him to, yes, if he had the opportunity, he would have taken his freedom. But he knew that God had placed him in that season of his life for a time like that. We were talking Wednesday night about, you know, if Paul hadn't gone to Jerusalem, if he hadn't gone to Rome, would we have half of the New Testament? Just think about how God used Paul, not only in those days, but to bless the church for ages to come. I hope you can take confidence in that as you face injustice and maybe seek justice on behalf of others. Amen? Let's pray.